Okay, welcome to Accommodations and Remediation. Up to this point, we have done a lot of describing of what this child looks like and what it feels like. But then there's always the question, what do we do? So we're going to talk about that some. And I will mention your handout first. Your handout is how the Barton program works. This is the Susan Barton program that we're pointing you towards. The Susan Barton program is an Orton-Gillingham-based program. There are several Orton-Gillingham-based programs in our country. To explain a little bit, what is an Orton-Gillingham program? It's a program that was put together by two individuals, Orton and Gillingham. They were psychologists and a language pathologist, I guess. Someone that really understood all of the workings of language. And he had understood the consistencies and been able to recognize this learning struggle and what was going on in it. But he didn't know what to do to help bring this phonetic knowledge into these people's lives. And Dr. Gillingham, she understood language from one end to the other and what all the pieces and parts of it were like. So he called on her with her knowledge and Dr. Orton working together. They developed a program that addresses the way these people think and what it is that the phonetic foundations look like and what they need. And that's where the Orton-Gillingham-based programs come from. They go all the way back to the 30s. This is nothing new. These programs were basically used in adult education, where you would have adults that had dropped out of school, gone about life, and they find themselves out there hemmed in because they can never go but so far with the limited education they have. So they want to go back and better themselves. And they go to the adult education programs. And the first thing they say is, you're going to have to learn to read and spell and things like that. So they would often go to the Orton-Gillingham-based programs because they're proven to work. An Orton-Gillingham program teaches phonics. That's all it is a phonics approach. But it teaches it in a way that has a lot of extra handles to hang on to. That's the way I describe it. It's got a lot of extras. It's got a lot of things that help you remember what's going on. And that's the reason it works for a dyslexic. See, a dyslexic does not only come pre-wired with this different wiring harness, which automatically struggles with sounds and letters. He also comes pre-wired with a characteristic that he needs to know and understand how things work. That's the reason these are the children that the parents tell us. He just takes everything apart to try to figure out how it works. She'll do craft things that are way above her age. She'll come up she'll attack sewing projects and maybe cooking. And a lot of the time, dyslexics, they cook without basically very little cookbook usage. Not just because cookbooks have words in them. That does have something to do with it, though. But they need to understand how these flavors go together and create these certain high points in flavor, what seasonings go together. And if you understand the knowledge of something, you can apply it over and over again in other situations. But if you're limited to the written word, And that's, you can ask my wife that. She's very non-dyslexic. She's a very good cook, but she needs her cookbook. And she's told me before, and I've heard her talking with others that could relate to that. That's the way they think. The non-dyslexic needs, and because of the fact that he needs to understand how things work, that's the reason the conventional phonics program can't meet his needs for his phonetic foundation. They don't go the extra mile to explain how things work and why you do it this way. And that's what your Orton-Gillingham programs do. Now, the Orton-Gillingham program that we would point you towards, and we would do this because we know it works, it would be the Susan Barton program. Probably you've heard of maybe Susan Barton. Her program is a program that works. We've got, in Montezuma, Georgia, we have four full-time tutors and 11 students going full-time on the Barton program. We're not just blessed with dyslexics down there either. We have three schools in our area, and these tutors work among all three schools. They work together. But once we have actually gotten the thing out on the table, and we've talked about what dyslexia looks like, and the teachers have brought forward students that they would like for us to screen, and parents have brought, you know, asked for screening, and we've gotten on the road dealing with this thing, this is what it takes to meet the needs of that community. Now, after we have gone through this initial slug, recognizing in the future, everybody is more aware of it. Now, recognizing and catching it in the future, at the early stages of school, is going to be the answer to it. Don't wait till a child is bogged down and discouraged and carrying a lot of baggage. But let's be aware of what it really is to process with difficulty. Because this this processing thing and being drugged down is something that can affect the way they feel about themselves and their confidence in all of life. And people tell me this. It's not only my experience, but that cloud that kind of goes through life hanging over our heads, it turns into a very real, frightening, negative place to exist. But the Barton program it's 25 years that she was working in this program. And it's not something that just popped up overnight. It is a very good program. And there's a couple of reasons that we point our small schools towards this program. Now, I do not work for Susan Barton. We get no reimbursement for this. We're out here just working in the field of dyslexia, but everybody wants to know, what do I do? And I don't want to point anyone towards something that won't work. That's the reason we point them towards something that will work and we know works. So, this program is for our small schools. First of all, you don't have to purchase a program per student like you do with some programs. And that's what this kind of explains, how the Barton program works. You don't have to purchase one per student. You can reproduce it. The student material is consumable, and you can reproduce it. That's the way it's designed. You buy a program for a school, and then it can be used as much as you need to. But some schools have gone a step beyond that. We really enjoy going around as we visit our schools in the Southeast, and especially the ones that are using the Barton program we knew were working with struggling students in the past. It's interesting to go back to that school and see their progress. Well, one of them shared with us what they're doing is they slip their Barton sheet program. They put the sheets in a clear sheet protector, and they give the student a dry erase pencil to work with. And when they're finished with the lesson, the teacher just wipes it clean and the next student comes in. So they don't even run copies in that school. There's enough of it out there that there's a lot of resource to draw from. Now, just before we closed in the last session, I mentioned about the scenario of the bookcase. You know, how the dyslexic and the non-dyslexic react to the directions and instructions. The one wants to read them, the other one wants to throw them away. Let's do another comparison scenario. Probably most of you have seen the card game Uno. Uno has cards that have color and numbers on them. So if I would have a stack of Uno cards, and those Uno cards were all mixed up, and here I had a non-dyslexic person, I gave them that stack of cards and said, told them to put them in some type of logical order. I don't care what the order is. You be good with it, but I'm going to leave it up to you. I come over here, I have a dyslexic person. I give them a stack of cards like that. Tell them the same thing. Whatever your order is, it's something for you to do. And I leave them with it. Come back over here in a little bit, and this person has theirs all laid out in a nice logical order that they're good with. I come over here, and this one looked at that stack of cards and turned it around and around and over and back and forth, and finally, bam, hit the top of the table. And they did scrape it back together into a smaller pile. We would think that needs some help. So I come over here and I ask this one, can you produce me a green five? Well, very quickly, out of their logical order here, they out comes that green five. Come over here. Can you produce me a green five? And the cards begin to flip, flop, and fly. And if they can still remember what they're looking for, they maybe can get me a green five after a little bit. Now, stepping back and looking at these two, we'd say this one definitely needs some help. But it's out of this pile right here that our inventors, our architects, our computer geeks, our brain surgeons, our talented cardiovascular surgeons, those people come out of this pile right here. Some of them barely could pass the entrance exams. Some of them had to have exceptions made so that they could even get into medical school. But once they crossed that hurdle, they shined. They were restricted by the literary restrictions. And we measure people, remember, too often by their academic abilities. How do you measure people like that? They don't fit anywhere. These people over here are very secure inside the box. I think we all probably understand what that I'm talking about. A person that thinks inside the box. These people are secure there. That's their security. If they can find it in writing, it just as well be cut in stone. It's the truth. These people, they don't even know what a box is. They've never been in it. They live out there somewhere. And that's the reason they find things out there. But these people scratch their head and wonder, where in the world did you ever come up with that? I don't know. If you could do this and that will happen, then I can use that same principle to apply over there. And that will happen. Well, yeah, you know, that is true. But how'd you come up with it? It's because I think outside the box. Now, I'm not trying to lift up one of these more than the other, but God does not make mistakes. We need these people to take the things that these people scratch up out there and put them into logical order so we can use them. And we can have material that explains them. It's these folks that write the directions for the bookcase. It's these people that invent the bookcase. God needs all of us. And we need to recognize that in working with these children. I had a teacher told me just not long ago, she said, I've got this little boy in my class. She said, he struggles and struggles, And he can't seem to keep his mind in what he's doing half the time. But he just struggles with his work. But she said, you know what he did? She said, my tape player quit working. And he came up to me and he asked me, this was a fourth grader, can I fix your tape player for you? An electronic tape, you know. She said, well, you can't tear up something that's broke. She said, go ahead. He fixed it. I think it was just something like a wire was disconnected inside. But he took the thing apart. And he started systematically going through that thing, looking for anything that was amiss. And he found it. Repaired it and it worked. I could tell this teacher was just blown away. His intelligence level went from right here to right there that quick. But that's like this board. I explained that in the last. We so often get distracted in trying to figure out what to do because we can't see what's wrong. Okay, another thing that we struggle with then is that if I do something extra for this child, is it fair to everyone else? If you would have a child in your class that was born without a leg from the knee down. I did. I had one in my class one time. And they had a false leg there. We would be willing to make all kinds of accommodations for that child. Because there's something I can see. This other thing is real too. It's just neurological. And we can't lay our eyes on it. But it exists. There's even evidence of it in their schoolwork. But we would make all types of accommodations to help that child survive. In our classroom, when we have a student that is struggling, and we have determined that it is a legitimate struggle. I mean, they're really trying. Just because we can't understand it does not mean it's not there. But there's ways to help. Reading and comprehension go together, but they're two separate things. When I have teachers to tell me that a child's reading and comprehension is terrible, I can tell they have these two smacked together. I ask them, let's pull these two apart. If you would read the material to this child and then let them orally answer you back, he'd get it then. Well, then there's nothing wrong with his comprehension. Comprehension is the ability to take in information and process it and return it and put it to use. Reading is standing right smack in the doorway, blocking it. That's what's going on. And we've got to realize that those two don't particularly go together because the child, reading and comprehension, there's a difference in comprehension in itself. I've had children that struggled with comprehension. You can see it almost in their eyes that they're not there. They're not comprehending. It's not there. An accommodation we can make for a child that struggles with this reading and comprehending would be to maybe read their work to them, or to pair them up with another student that has extra time, that it would work. You know, not all children work. Just put them together, but I call them reading buddies. Put them together, let the one help the other in the reading part of going through the lesson, and maybe there you would want to consider giving that child a test orally, giving them their quiz orally, or maybe making up a word box, a word bank to use, where you have the fill-in, the answer type things, to give them something to draw off of, to keep them from trying to completely build this word out of their knowledge. Be understanding what's going on here in the processing when we grade spelling and things. We ask them to write a story. And we see them gripping that pencil so hard, the poor pencil's probably gasping and choking, but he's got a death hold on it, and he's writing. And maybe he's writing his story, and these often children that can tell you all kinds of things, but they can't get it on paper hardly. So he's gotten into it. He's gotten the courage to attack this project. And he's getting your story down. They often have very interesting stories. But it's very discouraging, I know, to get back a project like that. It has red marks all over it because of misspelled words. Let's be careful. What are we looking for? Are we looking for content? Or are we looking for perfection in spelling and those things? In spelling, you know, the silent E that's at the end of words, I couldn't understand, where do you use them and where do you don't? You know, they say it doesn't hurt anything. It's a silent E. It just, you know, so I just, well, if they're free anyhow, I just slug them all over the place. I just tack them on the end of all kinds of words. And sure as the world, I'd come back with a paper that looked like a Christmas present. It was as red and marked up as it could be. Those are the things that they need to have. Those are the rules that something like the Barton program teaches them. The Barton program, some of the handles it gives in the Orton-Gillingham-based programs are using wooden tiles that have letters on them. And they actually are building and spelling words with those wooden tiles. And whenever you bring in the fine motor nerves, is just another avenue into the neurological input. Everything that you can incorporate, every sense you can bring into working. And you can use some of these things with your phonics programs. Try to think of ways to bring in extra input into forming letters and sounds, to cement into their mind the way these things work. And then drill. We were in Papua New Guinea 2 summers ago working with CLE down there at a teachers' conference. And we had teachers there, about 100 teachers there from all over the island. And one of the teachers was telling us that her school, her classroom is a bamboo hut. She has no chalkboard. She doesn't even have desk. But she said, we got lots of sand. And they just wipe the sand in there completely smooth. And each one of the children are given an area. And that's where they do their writing. And they take those children from ground zero. How fast have they been moving? 6 months. She had them fairly fluent in the English language and writing it as well. But see, she didn't realize that her resource, her only resource, was a huge help to what was going on there. I'm sure you've heard of different ways and different things. I had a first grade teacher that used to use shaving cream on the desktops and things like that. Let the children write in that. Oh, they find it interesting, but really there is a benefit in some of these things. But these accommodations that we're willing to make to reach these children, helping them find the answers. Another one is children that are working with math. I haven't gotten a chance to really mention math much, but we process letters and numbers differently. Letters are symbols that represent sounds that go together to build words. Okay, numbers are symbols that represent values. And we process those two numbers and letters and their uses differently. But however, children that work with, that are dyslexic, it can fade over into the directional issues of working with numbers. But if it's severe enough, the struggle with numbers, consider to go one step further and really look at that close, because there is a condition. Just like letters are to dyslexia, numbers are to dyscalculia, is what it's called. Dyscalculia. It's interesting if you have the ability to go online to look up dyscalculia and what it looks like. It is something that needs to have a special program that helps children understand the use of numbers in a different way. Because a person that's dyscalculic, see, I can't even understand that. But numbers don't make any sense to me. A 37 and a 61, one's just as good as the other. It doesn't matter to me. They can't seem to grasp the way values and symbols work together. They have to be taught a different way. And as I was studying this a little bit, I haven't gotten to where I want to be in it yet, but as I was studying it, I thought, oh, this is so similar to dyslexia, because there's a certain special glitch right here in that wiring harness. So that there is, as people ask about, what about math? I want to share that because you may have something you need to look into. But mainly, the accommodations are going to be specialized programs that address the specialties of how sounds and phonics is built. See, when, as I mentioned before, when we decode a word, we use our phonetic tools to do it. As we look at words, we see them, we pull them apart, we see all the sounds in there, and they go back together. And the dyslexic, they can't, because of their processing slowly and their phonetic tools, they do this slowly. But if they have their phonetic tools in a way that they think, they will actually see words differently. When they see a word, they will attack it and decode it differently. That's one of the things these special programs do. That's like the Barton program. It shows them how to divide a word. It shows them how to see in this word different syllables and sounds, and to recognize there is rules that do not change as to how letter combinations work and how syllables are put into a word. And as they learn this, when they look at a word, that knowledge comes forth, and those are the very tools they use. Where the child that's the non-dyslexic doesn't need those. He can get it from the conventional phonics program. So it's basically giving them their tools they need to work with. And it will make a difference. It will make a difference if it's done correctly. Okay, I'm going to stop here. We kind of ran out a little bit of time before on question and answer, because I'd like to hear from you, give you a chance to talk. Yes?
I've had a couple of students in the same family that I've taught, and they give evidence for their work that there was dyslexia there. But the same children are also, I'll say, happy go lucky, and it's been hard to separate between what could be helped and what could not be helped. How much of it was due to a lack of not getting much care, and how much of it was truly disability. Now, is the happy go lucky mannerism a cover up, or so they don't appear to be minding, or is that actually complicating it so that it makes it hard for us to know when to expect better of that and when not to?
It can be a cover-up. And that's something I want to touch. I'm not trying to muddy up the waters for you. Anybody that's determining exactly what you're trying to do there, looking at a situation, is this disobedience? Is this an attitude? Is this just don't care? Or what is this? Or is it really a lack of ability? So often, in working with students, and really getting to the trying to get to the root of their problem, we kind of dig down through several layers of things. Things that looked almost like they could if they would. But those things were put on there to try to hide what was underneath. And more often than not, we dig down to the lack of ability is lying at the bottom of it, but they don't want anybody to know that. Sometimes even naughtiness will be resorted to just to hide the fact that I can't and I don't want you to know it, so I'm going to use distraction. And in distraction, I'll just be naughty enough to get you off my back on this work, even if it's going to get me into trouble again. And sometimes we make the decision that I would rather wear the badge of a naughty boy than a dumb boy. Because that will kind of, in my peers, I'll kind of at least be somebody. Maybe even somebody some of the other fellows would like to try to be. So it's not easy to determine that, but there's one area that I caution us all in, and that's going to the fact of letting it become personal with us. Personal defiance if they don't perform. I told you to do this, why didn't you do it? You know, don't let it become something that they're personally defying me by not doing it, because that is a different angle. It's going to send me around a different way to take care of this thing. That can be very detrimental in my relationship with this child. Because most students, and I'm going to say this with confidence, most students want to perform. They really want to. I don't know that I've ever met a child that just didn't want to know things. They'll act like it. But it's a natural inquisitiveness that I believe God gave mankind to seek out answers. But what is more powerful than that is what I think of myself and what I fear others think of me and where this whole thing is going to carry me. So I'll go start going to other things to hide that in accommodation sometimes are not accepted very well because they feel like it exposes them. And that's where working as a teacher with your class as a team, to where everybody pulls together for everybody, is so important to build that team relationship. That way I can give the extra attention, the extra help. No one minds it. Sometimes I think they're even pleased with the fact that she's getting some help. He's going to do that for her. Anything else? Yes, ma'am.
I have a little boy up in Tiverton in February. He just turned 10 in March. And when I started with him, his teacher said he doesn't do well at math. And it wasn't far to try to back to. He didn't know his math facts. Starting on the position. And over time, I realized that, like he said, he has no math sense. Things don't work together for him. And you gave me a name for it. It's called Freedom. And are there programs, equivalent programs, like there are in the Barton programs for these children?
This is an internet research you need to do. I haven't gone very deep into that. Enough to see some of the programs, just kind of lightly touching it. But what they all do is try to establish a value system that they can see that symbol as a value. And there is a program of teach that is used to teach math with. Some of you may have heard of Math UC. That's a good program. It teach for children that struggle with math. It uses manipulatives to build problems with, and the child needs to build the problem. We use this same thing with other math programs. You can do the same thing. I like to use a board similar to this. You can get them smaller at Walmart. Probably magnets will stick on this. But the ones at Walmart I get do a magnet. And I get little magnetic objects or just magnets themselves at Hobby Lobby or Michaels or somewhere like that. And we can take those objects and we can actually build problems. Let the child write the problem and build the problem. All of that input helps them wrap their brain around the way this thing works. 3 + 8. And then let them stick 3 objects, write a plus sign, put 8 objects there, equals sign, add everything up, count them all up, put the answer down. Building that problem helps them, then when they face building facts in their mind, that will help them go there. Be careful how you steal away from children the survival tools they have, like of counting with their fingers. Some teachers think you have got to break that. Be careful.
For these children, sorry for interrupting.
Go ahead.
Maybe more appropriate for letting these children, who's really heavy on the fingers and trying to break that, but they keep coming back up to help them.
Mm-hmm. There's really nothing wrong with that. How many adults do you see doing that?
Well, normally they'll figure it out.
That's right. Okay. But you may really handicap him in his learning process. That's right.
Okay.
Because that may be the way right now. That's a big neurological input for him that you could throw some sand in his gears.
Okay.
Those things are all big helps for children. The other objects that you could bring into it, the manipulatives. I encourage you to look for ways to bring things like that in.
Are there children that are more dyslexic than others that he might need marking this for him, but this one could probably take a few.
Dyslexia can be so mild you can barely detect it. It can be so mild that you almost have to look for other characteristics to identify it. And it can be so profound that a person will not read or spell without intervention. And we've seen the whole spectrum there. But if you determined that something is going on, and if you have determined that they are dyslexic, I would encourage you not to spend a whole lot of time in conventional phonics. It doesn't get to where the dyslexic needs to be.
And another question, why don't we just teach this to the whole class so then we're all connected?
Yeah, that's my question too. Why do we have Barton programs? Why do we make Barton programs conventional?
You'll bore them to death. Yeah, if they're not dyslexic, it's like, okay, we understand that. Let's get on. I mean, yeah. But see, that's the thing of the Barton program that makes it effective for the dyslexic, is they're slow to grab this, and they need the extras to hang on to it. And it's all these extra handles it has on it. These others don't need, I mean, you would just bore them like everything. Yes, ma'am.
Would you recommend it for every age?
Yes, the Barton program is designed. What it is it builds phonetic foundation from the ground up. And the oldest person that went successfully through the program was 86 years old, I think. It's designed to build phonetic foundation.
So you can do it at any age and it's still.
Yeah. That's and so far as how young, you need to have enough phonics in this situation to determine that you do have an issue. You don't want to jump the gun on it, but I would say probably pretty well through the first grade in a conventional, and they're going to expose themselves by then. You'll be able to, they'll have enough phonics that you could see how they're building on that phonics program. And if that foundation is not doing what it needs to do, I wouldn't waste much time in going to one that has more handles on it. Not go push on to the third and fourth grade. Yeah. I'm going to liken this dyslexic thing to a handicap. I don't like to do that. But just for this reason. If we had a child that was handicapped and we were going to give them therapy, the more therapy we get and the continuous therapy of like a program like the Barton program, we wouldn't want to skip any of the therapy. But we could give them, if the therapy isn't approaching the issue from the way of building what's missing, just to repetitively do it is not. It takes a long time for that to do much good. That's a mistake most teachers make. If somebody, and I've been there, you know, if he's not good in this, he just needs to do more of it. You know, if we've got a child that's missing part of a hand, they were born that way. When we're out in the gym, we're all learning how to dribble. And this child just does not dribble good at all. So, normal logic, they just need to dribble more. So we give them more time to dribble. And more, and more, and more. And we see a little bit of increase. But you know that child can dribble forever and he's never going to grow the rest of that hand. We're going to have to address the issue that's in place. And that's, you know, addressing the issue. When we say that someone is dyslexic, how did we come to that conclusion? Were they screened? Is this a shot in the dark? You know, I hear that. And I hear that, you know, people tell me I've got a student that's dyslexic. First thing that flies in my mind is, how do you know? What was the evaluation process? Yes, sir.
When you're talking about variety and so on, what effect does typing have? And seeing the words on the screen and auto-suggestion of words that a program does, and how about touch typing, the relationship of the, I mean, does the mechanics of that feel different?
It does. The struggle is the process of the letters and finding the letters. Dyslexics can learn to type well. I could type pretty good at one time until I got away from it for so long. But it's not a fix for it, though. It's not a fix for it because with typing, I'll come back to cursive. That brought up something I hadn't touched. The typing, you've got to learn your keyboard, know your keyboard, and then you've still got to build the word. The wonderful thing about typing, especially if it's on a computer, is you have spell check. I love those. But the cursive thing, it's difficult often for these children in their writing. They struggle with writing normally. Their writing doesn't look good because, see, their writing reflects the way they're processing. It's hard. The letters, the sounds, the word, what it looks like. Cursive's not supposed to work like that. Cursive works flow. So, they can print and kind of goes along with typing almost. But cursive needs to flow if it looks any good anyway. But for a dyslexic, cursive to look decent, they've got to train themselves. I had to do this because my teacher gave me a fit. Don't move your pencil. The front, like when I'm going to spell a word, the first couple letters are stop. Start up all over again. Stop. Finish it. Put a Y on the end. Or one of those silent E's or something. You know. That's a tough way to write cursive. So to be able to write cursive may be something for you to take into consideration for a child that struggles with getting their thoughts down on paper and border on dysgraphia. Cursive can work, but it's going to be a slow process. It's going to flow slowly and probably kind of jerky. Did I answer your question? Okay. I felt like I took off on a bunny trail and I'm not sure if I got back. Okay, that was our two bells, y'all. We want to be respectful of the schedule, but we will be around. If you have questions or things that come up, come to your mind, flag us down, corner us up. We'll be glad to help in any way we can. You are dismissed.